Lost my heart and hope to die. If I ever, ever told a lie, feelings and guilty just said, choose a bad place when you're dead. Washington, he never lied.
Hello and welcome back to our podcast, but a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Hi, I'm Fi. I'm joined once again with my co-host, Weird. Say hello, Weird.
I'm afraid that the only person to answer your demand is one Sir Weirdington Esquire.
Yes, our very smug jukebox. So, hey, yeah, we're back in again, folks. Episode 41, chapter 47, I think. We're almost done the book. We just have this chapter and the next chapter, and this is really more like a part one and part two of this particular chapter, is more what it feels like anyways. Then we'll be doing our recap the week after.
Oh, on the plus side, Somber won't be able to dick us around with like a quiet chapter.
Yeah.
Because they'll be, oh my god, wouldn't that be amazing if he like sequesters them in a fucking broom closet long enough to like have a wasted, like, to waste our time with an entire chapter.
Yeah, or just everyone just everyone gets
just out of tradition, just out of bloody minded,
everyone just sits around and talks about their feelings for all chapter, and how Blackjack ruined everyone's lives again, and how she's forgiven immediately anyways.
You ruined all our lives, and also you were the best person to ever live, and we'll follow you into the depths of hell.
God. So,
because we have no objectives or like goals or desires of our own.
We just
so what happened last
week? Yeah, what happened last week?
I can't remember if it was last week or last week, but the week before, where they polished off the Steel Rangers.
Gosh, I don't remember.
Anyway,
it all kind of mushes together.
I can't remember if it was part of the recap or part of the actual episode. Anyway, so the Steel Rangers are banished. They're driven away in an incredibly frustrating and implausible way that should have gotten them all killed. just more character assassination on the part of on everybody on Team Blackjack. Meanwhile, and so everybody slut shames Blackjack for her infidelity, sleeping with squeaky muscle boy Dracula. So she broadcasts her horny boast to the world. Then they all go down together and visit Ghoul Town to hang out with some pony zombies who are just living their best death.
They're just vibing, bro.
That was all in episode before last, because we open up at the resolution of a dumb cliffhanger, where we're in, that's not what happens, but it might as well have, Blackjack is seen standing over a dead body, holding a knife. We open up to the beginning of next episode, and the murder victim gets up and says, "Oh, I spilled jam all over me!" We recruit a bunch of idiots who I'm sure will be very important to the story going forward, including, implausibly, way back in Chapter 3, we ran across an insane glowing ghoul whose glow is actually, like, toxic? Like, painfully, like, toxic? To any living thing that prolonged exposed to it, and completely, like, inconsolably insane. And so apparently this group takes 3 months off of the main quest to go, like, backtrack all the way to where that motherfucker is lit, where they found that thing, to somehow implausibly negotiate to, like, have it come along on a trip with them on another 3-month jaunt all the way back to the site of the current adventure.
It's important to remember that the 3 months aren't real. Like, that's...
Oh wait, no, they can teleport. Yeah. They now have fast
travel. Yeah, they just Lacuna.
It is... You mean to tell me you could have done that for us at any time? Not at any time, only when it's convenient.
Yes. Well, it's well, that's the thing, is like, I could get into every single time you have a problem with something, and I can just be like, well, there's actually like a logical reason, because it goes out of its way to always have a reason. But I mean, like, does it matter at this point? Like, I could...
Yeah, I mean, the reason, like, there are reasons, but they are very dumb and often extremely ad hoc. And frustrating.
Yeah.
have like it's just a blooming fractal of frustration.
For the listener, Alicorns can recharge their magic powers off of radiation, and the teleportation uses a bunch of her magical power. So she has to like skinny dip in some ooze every time she needs to like do one of these fast travel trips. Since it takes a lot of teleportation magic and to do a lot of people all in one go as well, so that's why they can't just.
Oh, we could just strap this glowing mind control tool to her side, and she can do it indefinitely.
Then she's just invincible. Yeah. Just duct tape. just the concept, like just duct tape this nuclear rod to your body, and you're unkillable.
So we needed that plot device to get through to make a non-event over a sewer completely jam-packed with zombies, mindless zombies, as opposed to the cool towny zombies.
Yeah, it's another story decision I would chalk up to like this is the kind of thing that makes sense in a video game because like video games like have roadblocks. And, like, it's like, okay, you can't get in... Okay, we're going to go into Hightower. Why has the player never been able to get into Hightower up to this point? Well, the only entrance is full of ghouls, and it's super deadly. So you have to go to... You have to do all of this quest chain just so you can get told that the one character can get you through this section. And up until that point, it's virtually impossible. Like, that's the kind of way you, like, roadblock a, like a video game, like a sandbox video game. But it doesn't work. Like I guess it's not that it doesn't work in a story. It's just that it's just not interesting in a story. Like, we don't need to... Like, nothing makes us care about the idea of, like, okay, we have a lock. Where's the key? Oh, there's the key. And, like, the whole methodology of how to get that key isn't really that exciting to read in a story. Like novelizations of video games are... almost universally bad, partly because of this issue of trying to make sense of like the video gaminess, the stuff you just sort of like accept as part of the genre and medium that doesn't work outside of it. And I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about like adaptational problems again recently, and this is just another one that came to mind.
And it would probably be better if like. Somber had a better than a cargo cult understanding of like how and why those gates exist.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fun instructional thing. Polygon has a video. I think it was Polygon. Anyway, there's a video out on YouTube of the two lead designers of Outer Worlds watching a speed run of their game.
Mm-hmm.
And flipping being in this very interesting emotional space of lament and awe as they watch him like as they watch this person like circumvent everything they built like oh we thought we were okay so what's the next gate he needs to get to talking in very like that like okay so we gated off this and this and this in these particular ways. Like, how did he circumvent or, like, quick through that? And, like, you know, what route could he have possibly... Like, I'm trying to speculate what he's going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... And also, like, occasionally going, but he never talked to...
Yeah.
Oh, this... Well, okay, he's halfway... He's halfway to his finish line, and he... This is the first time he's spoken to them. It was supposed to be a, like, constant, like, through line of and then ultimately watching him get the sort of gag ending that is only available if you have extremely low int. And so, like, well, man, I sure did think I was clever when I put that in there. But anyway, like, the gating happens so that you can, like, learn about things in a curated, like, linear... and that only works if you have, like, a plan.
Yeah.
For the things the characters, like, interact with and, like, the growth of their perspective and their understanding of the world.
So I guess, like, yeah, Fi and Weird's writing corner when it comes to this sort of stuff is that one of the things that works in video games that doesn't work in a book is that, like, you can have simultaneous experiences happening with a video game where you have, like, your main story, and then in a sufficiently sandboxy game, at any point you can just, like, go into an alley and go talk to some random person and maybe get a side quest. And, like, these this entire, like, community is trying very desperately to try and recreate that vibe, whether I think they realize it or not. And the problem is that with a book, books are on one level, right? Like, they build these big, lurid narrative worlds that, like, feel like this big, expansive thing, but you're mostly going in one direction, and there is at no point you cannot stop your book and read another book that's happening in your book, you know? And, like, there's...
I mean, well, I was about to say, you can. Like, that happens in manga, like, or at least, like, with, like, the, like... mini chapters at the end of some chapter, like here's like 2 pages of another thing.
So sure
that like we had to like that would not have worked in like but again the thing is it would have not have worked in the main story, like that in order to do this you need to have it a separate book.
Yeah,
you can't have a pit stop in the novel. Like you can do like short, like, okay, here's a side story. With in the collection of side stories,
yeah.
Like, here's a thing that occurred to me that like happened like in the space of edits,
yeah.
But it's in a corner, and the video game experience is much like that. You have the main story of the video game, and then you can, because it is like your personally curated experience, you can put down the book that is the main game. Like it's segmented in your brain as a separate like line in a window inside the game. Like you could see, like, here's main novel, here's like main quest, and then it's segregated into, okay, and then here's the side quest. And so you can like take a break from the novel you're reading to go read a short story is what the equivalent in a video game of a side quest is. But it does not work to put a bunch of short stories like break up a novel.
So the reason why it doesn't work, because I feel like we're kind of like not explaining that very well, is the reason why it doesn't work is because since you're reading a story in a row in succession, it feels like a massive digression and a huge gear shift to suddenly go into a different story. Like, one of the biggest problems we keep talking about Project Horizon specifically is that the story feels like it lacks focus, and it certainly does. Like, it absolutely does. Like, that's without question. But a lot of the reason why it lacks focus is primarily because the story stops whenever it feels like telling a different story for a while. Like, this story is a little bit better than others about, like, handling, like, what I'm going to call dungeons equivalently, where you have, like, story happening, and then you hit a location that has its own vibe and sort of mini arc to it in that location. It's just sometimes those aren't done very well, like in the case of the mine or the case of, like, going through all of Sanguine's, like the Hippocratic Research Facility. That it's a self-contained idea, but the problem is that, like, broadly, the arcs are such, like, huge shifts in terms of, like, what's happening and the tone of what's happening and the enormity of what's happening. Like, there's no growth in scale. A lot of time the story will stop dead to do, like, a whole war arc, or Blackjack just hangs out in a mindscape for a while, and it doesn't feel like it amounts to anything because the story is constantly stopping itself to tell other stories within its story, yeah. And it feels it's distracting, like it's just noise. Whether or not it's compelling or not has nothing to do with it. It's just it's a huge break in tempo that doesn't serve the story in any significant way.
You're gonna be really great for stuff like that, editors.
Yeah.
whoops, doodle. Anyway, and the one final piece of the recap, or two final things. One, we finally come to the end, the final dungeon for this disc, which is this big giant crazy hell building, spewing lava and filled with insane ghouls. Very atmospheric, very cool, very impressive. I can't wait to be underwhelmed by its actual contents. And something that my brain misfired on me last week, and I feel really bad about it. Fi was super eager to talk about how it doesn't make sense to him that this incredibly racist, this black nationalist zebra living inside, Rampage's head. Everything we knew about this donkey, before we found out she was, some kind of black nationalist, was that she lived an entire lifetime with somebody and had a kid with them, and that somebody was a pony.
Yes.
It was a non-zebra, and so to come out and reintroduce this character as somebody who is fervently anti-pony and zebra purist seems like a swerve, and even though it almost certainly is a swerve, like I think that Occam's razor would insist that this is merely incompetence on the part of Somber, like he's lost the only editor to who can tell him what to do since he wrote that part, and in fact because Rampage is that dude's precious baby OC, well six OCs. It does make sense that the character would completely change with a changing of hands. That dude is no longer around to say what Rampage is and does. And so this is now Somber's like take on the character.
Mm-hmm.
You could do a bit of apologetics and say that I mean I don't trust Somber to actually know this or understand this, but racists are like really great at hypocrisy. Like Howard Phillips Lovecraft was an astonishingly anti-Semitic racist, and he married a Jewish woman who had to like periodically remind him in the middle of anti-Semitic rants that darling, you do know you're married to one.
Yeah, he just in such like a fervor he forgot.
Yeah, and in addition, there is like sort of a long history pointed out by many comedians through the ages that some people with like racial resentments can put them aside and have like long fulfilling relationships with people. But if that relationship ends on any sort of an ugly note, like in any sort of tragedy or they will often sort of double down performatively on their racism.
Mm-hmm.
The actual answer is that Somber is probably just incompetent and or like sort of putting his scent on Rampage.
Mm.
Like saying, this is my Rampage now.
Yes. I licked her. You can't touch her anymore.
Yeah. You're gone. I get to say what this character is like now. But there is an apologetic answer, which is that like maybe it's just it's hyper performative, like the relationship ended badly with the pony. They lost their child, and she feels personally responsible because she's living in the same body as the person who killed the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's now very performatively racist.
Yeah, which so, I would not like. That's giving so much benefit. Like that's giving so much good faith to this character when like the reality is, yeah, it's just, it's a mistake. Like it's very obviously a mistake because this is never really brought. Like, okay, so I doubt it's actually a mistake. I think what it actually is, Somber has no idea what this character's in, like, voice, and by voice I mean like characterization, like the way they communicate and act to other people, had no idea what that was going to be for Shuja, because we've only ever been given her in like offhand accounts, really. Like, we've basically never really interacted with her up to this point, so he had no idea what she was going to seem like, and wanted to go for like erudite, I guess, but like accidentally did a racism with it.
That's just Somber's conception of erudite.
Well, it's
just a monocle, pinky out, dignity, extreme racism.
I think it's just that he didn't really consider the concept of like the in context, saying, uttering the line, like being distrustful of technology and also being distrustful of the equestrian trade agreements, how that comes across in the context of the character you're talking about. Because when it's a immortal Zebran war god, like, bullshit character, it has a very different tone than if it's just, like, a paranoid, like, so, like, in the case of Xanthe, or the Zebra Remnant, like, the Zebra Remnant are all a cargo cult of Zebran culture, like, they're just as broken over there as they are here in Equestria, so a lot of, like, the culture and tradition is just shit they kind of half remember, and it's not, like, an unbroken chain like people like to think it is. With Xanthe, her being, like, nationalistic makes sense because she's falsely interpreting her own culture as being more nationalistic than it was. But when it's an actual character from that time speaking that stuff, it comes across like your, like, 70-year-old racist dad. Like, it doesn't come across the same way. It's like, tone is critically important in the circumstance, and it's just a flubbed line because it's never really, Shuja is never really characterized like this again. She's largely defined by the fact that she had a relationship with an equestrian.
Yeah.
So it's just, but it's an error.
Yeah. So it's, we're coming up on 25 minutes in, because I dropped two pretty big conversation balls last episode. So what happens? What happens this episode? What happens this chapter?
I don't know. I think it was very important to talk about the substance of the work and not just dry recitation, as I've often mentioned. But yes, chapter 47, Hightower. I'm going to call this Hightower Part 1. So it'd be Hightower Part 1, Hightower, as opposed to Hightower Part 2, whatever, you know.
With a vengeance. Yeah.
Hightower.
Tower harder.
oh, man. Live free in Hightower.
So what happens?
Okay, so...
What happens? We're in the foyer of Hellbuilding.
All right, so I've taken to naming the episodes, giving these episodes, like, epithets. And this one is God, Blackjack is a bullshit character episode. I was so mad reading this yesterday, and that'll become apparent in a second.
Oh boy.
So something that I feel failed to be conveyed over the course of the last chapter is that Silver Spoon, who is the like flaming, like the like glowing ghoul who can like talk to other ghouls and all that shit, she has cottoned on to the fact that Blackjack isn't her friend from the past, and her friend is probably dead, and she's like more aware of like the circumstances of her death and zombification, and she's no longer living in a weird fantasy world, I guess. Because in this in the start of this chapter, she's like totally lucid now. Like she's just been like, the scales have been lifted from her eyes entirely. Over the course of like maybe three sentences, because they need to trick the warden, because like the warden of the building is like some sort of crazed ghoul who's like yelling over the speaker system, and she like yells at him because she worked for the Ministry of Morale, so she was a pink, which is just means she was a like she worked for the people who would kidnap and blackbag people. So she has a lot of authority to be able to like talk over this guy
for surprise parties.
Yes. The surprise parties that you mysteriously never want to come back from because you enjoyed it so much. But yeah, they trick the warden into at least getting the like robo guards to stand down, but there's still tons and tons of ghouls in the area. And like, I still want to give this credit where credit is due. The actual narrative experience of going through this tower is a fun one and definitely feels like the end of a story. Like every time we come to the end of these books, there is these like the intensity is really railed up so high that it makes me wonder like why not have more of this kind of thing and kind of like pace yourself better instead of just doing like boring meandering storytelling and then like these big giant pops at the last second that like make me excited for once. But like everything about the way this building is designed and structured is given a really strong description, because since it's a prison, like the whole prison system is it's a bunch of like central like a bunch of catwalks and then like a central tower that's the security tower, like the something of like the Panopticon kind of thing, where like there's a giant security structure in the middle and then like all of the like holding cells and living quarters and everything are sort of structured around it. And there's a giant warhead stuffed in the middle of that that's currently like raining hot like literally magical fire that can melt through anything onto everything, and all the like ghouls and just everything about this, the way that this is described is just fucking like gonzo. Like this would be where all your budget goes in a movie kind of shots, just CGI everywhere. They creep around as they're trying to like avoid ghouls as they're moving around, since they don't have to worry about the robot guards anymore for the time being.
Want to pause you real quick? I'm real frustrated by like the obviousness, the inevitable like laziness of, oh, now she's completely lucid.
Yes.
And it kind of disrespects mental illness again.
Yeah, just a little bit.
There's a version of this character that could be really interesting and like heart-tuggingly tragic, of like that they be part of the brain is aware of what's happening, but they're like in a dream state, like they're in a brain rot induced dream state where they like drift from like, oh, this is my friend, back to, oh my god, I'm dead. And then the like conversation between her and this, or like her response to this dude yelling over the intercom, could be very interesting and nuanced. Of like, in her mind, like she's like straddling a line between she's part of this Horses 11 heist, and also she's still alive, still a member of the ministry, irritated by this fool who's gibbering on the job. Her brain is straddling the difference between these are deputies under my command, and these are some zombies and weirdos that I'm helping do a heist.
So effectively like suffering something similar to like dementia, basically. Or like,
yeah,
she's not a
could have been interesting.
Yeah,
isn't the case.
Like you could have had a fun reveal with this chapter where it's like where she does her like this whole thing where she yells at him and stuff, and they're like, oh cool, so you're aware, and then it's very clear that she's like glazed over, and like it just happened to be that like what they needed her to do also like coincided with whatever like fantasy she's currently living out, and there's this kind of like sad, I don't know, like, we need her help, but we don't know. Like there's a certain amount of duplicitous in how we basically have to manipulate her, but she's on board now, but isn't all there. Regardless, yeah. It's another character. It's another situation of like Fury, where like it's a dropped ball that I wish was given more consideration than is. Like these are the kind of characters I would much rather have in the story than like our main cast of shitty nobodies. There is a really bizarre line of conversation where they're talking to the like various members of the crew that are like over 2 centuries old, and they're talking about Luna and her government and like how that was all structured. And there's like a really like shitty, dumb, stupid thing that's happening here where like they talk about how like Luna's government is and how she was very hands off and how like hooves off, and how that like made the government feel like alienated from the rest of civilization and all this shit, which is really just there to be like a metaphor to equivocate like to Blackjack specifically, where like she's like they talk about it, and then like Blackjack just kind of like rambles openly about how like that's frustrating, that like this like figurehead like felt so aloof and untouchable and alienating, and that she could have done better. And then like Rampage makes like a knowing smile, and it's like, yeah, it's basically like, that's you, Blackjack, you're complaining about you.
Nonsense! I am the people's horse!
There's a lot of, like, there's a very weird dynamic going on with this particular chapter where, like, I guess it's to more recontextualize, like, Rampage a little bit better. Like, this is a sequence that, like, I don't necessarily hate either, where, since Rampage is, like, long since sort of lost any sort of real particular motivation in the story, through this chapter, it kind of feels as if, like, in a subtle way for once, Rampage is, and vicariously the writer, is trying to feel out like why it is that Rampage like puts so much faith into BJ, even though she clearly knows that BJ is just as fucked up as she is, and like what is the attraction there, essentially, like why is she following her, which like I mean like if the story didn't currently include 11 characters, like I'd be way more down for this happening, because it means that like we actually get some proper character interaction that isn't just, like, two characters sitting in a waiting room talking about how, like, one of them almost killed their own daughter. Like, it would be cool to have this kind of, like, actual subtle dialogue writing for once. But, yeah, luckily the cop horse, who I guess is a nurse. I don't know, I was very confused about this between my readings, where the chapter she's introduced, she talks about how she was a cop. But I guess she's also been a nurse? Whatever, she's been a ghoul for a long time, so I guess it makes sense that she has a variety of skills. But she is giving them directions, because she used to work at this prison, basically, on how to best avoid this. They fight, like, super irradiated ghouls for a while. That isn't terribly exciting. The only, like, additional hink in fighting them is that these ghouls are so irradiated that they regenerate super quickly because of the like ambient amount of radiation in the environment is constant source of nourishment to their like mutated zombie forms. So they're really hard to kill. The whole scene caps with Xanthe, who's still in the story for some reason, accidentally shooting Blackjack in the stomach with a shotgun, because a running gag in the story is everyone who's friends with Blackjack has tried to kill her at least once. So it's the initiation is shooting Blackjack, basically.
Okay.
But yeah, they have like a short post getting shot in the stomach hoedown. They like hide in a security office while they're like, BJ is trying to recuperate from the bullet wounds. So she has regeneration now, and she can just like heal from wounds given time.
Okay.
It's not terribly exciting.
It's not a normal cyborg. It's not normally a thing that I associate with cyborgs. But
well, sure. She is a magic cyborg. Keep that in mind.
Yeah. It's whatever.
Yeah, I can go into more depth about it, but like, she's as long as she has metal and power, she can regenerate wounds with cybernetics. Which, man, that'd have been a lot cooler of a concept if she was like slowly being replaced with like synthetic equivalent to whatever her body is missing. Like, it's like, okay, you got a giant gut wound. It's like, okay, it can't, like, repair you, but it can replace, like, the parts of you there with, like, metal and fiber and stuff. And, like, the idea of slowly over time becoming, like, an actual, like, the actual threat of becoming a full cyborg being a big thing would be, like, more impactful and more ever-present in the story. But whatever, I'm basically just fan fictioning right now. They go into a kitchen for a while where they fight more evil slime, which I initially was going to hate, but I kind of dig the scene because, like, since it's like a full prison kitchen, the entirety of the floor of the kitchen is all the like acidic slime. So like they basically have to play the floor as lava while trying to dodge like acid slime monsters, which is kind of fun. there's a lot of really cool tension of them, like, having to try and, like, manipulate the, like, the metal, because the metal won't get eaten as nearly as fast as organic stuff, so they're trying to, like, move fridges and metal stuff in the way so they can get to, like, the various parts of the kitchen to get out of it. And, like, with, like, the additional, like, ratchet of tension of, like, because they have a pair of flyers as well, right, that can just fly over all of this. And they get caught in a thing that happens that I thought was, like, again, I think is pretty cool. I'm just trying to go through this fast, because we got a lot to go through. Where, like, in the kitchen, in a tense moment, like, the fire sprinklers get set off, which they immediately think, like, oh, well, it'll wash away all the slime, but since the slime is in the, like, water system entirely, they just get rained on with even more of it, and it ends up fucking up their flyers, which I thought was a neat, like, thing. They end up killing the slimes using electricity, because apparently that works on them. They basically just toaster in a bathtub. The things. Like, I'm making it sound boring because of trying to explain it like this, but it definitely
Because you can't, like, it's an action set piece, and, like, that's net, like, requires a, like, very specific kind of, like, of talent to convey.
Yeah.
Especially in brief.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, a lot of the excitement of an action set piece are the moment to moment, trying to do this podcast about any, like, good movie or piece of, like, exciting adventure fiction would have the same problem. Mm-hmm. Like, the moment to moments of any, like, action set piece are dull as shit outside of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, yeah, the direct experience of it is the thing that makes it exciting. I was just sitting here thinking, like, if somebody put a gun to my head and forced me to write one of these, like, if I was or compelled by one of my more perverse muses to demand it of me, I think it would be a more efficient use of, like, words and page space to just, like, write a design document for these dungeon set pieces, like, instead of, like, walking you through, like, all the, like, various happenings, like, it might be interesting to just, like, okay, so here's the map of, like, this floor, and, like, or, like, more practically, like, do, like, a D&D, like, module, to just write up, if you want to experience BJ's adventure in hell building, here's what the third floor was like.
Yeah.
And instead of, like, writing out the, like, minute to minute happenings, just, like, if this were a video game, this is what you, the player, would encounter, and then beginning the story again on the other side of the map page.
Yeah.
Like, I doing a quick recap of, like, okay, we're out of bullets now, I guess.
So I think one of the,
and Jim is dead.
I think one of the big weaknesses of this particular sequence is that because it's not against, like, any, like, antagonists, it's just traps, basically. It's hard to be invested in the, like, moment-to-moment in any real significant way, because there's no reason why they're in here except for to do the fucking main quest. And so, like, there's no...
And they have no particular motive or engagement with the main quest, is what I said. Yeah, as I said earlier. So, yeah, like...
Yeah, like, there's no time... There's no clock. There's no bad guy to fight here. It's just wandering around a death trap because you're doing it. But yeah, anyways, also a detail of this is what starts happening. It's sort of hard to pin down exactly how much this happens and when it happens, but, like, Rampage starts, like, switching into her alternate personalities way, way more consistently during this, because normally she's just in and out of it for a little bit, and they shoot her in the head and whatever. They call it a day. But, like, for whatever reason in this particular building, we get two differences to it. A, the personalities seem to assert themselves without any sort of exterior stimulus, because it used to be that, like, Rampage needed some sort of event that would, like, trigger the other personalities. So, like, a situation in which, like, they were, like, around, like, psychiatry situations, like, Dr. Octopus would appear, or like if they were in a position where like, you know, cop things had to happen, then the cop personality would appear, that sort of thing. But they seem to just be able to just like bubble to the surface at like at their own leisure, and they're also aware of the circumstances of what's happening and like are commenting to Blackjack as if like they're completely lucid of the circumstances. Like there's a bit where like Shuja shows up, like the zebra personality, but like uses information and knowledge that Rampage knows to talk to Blackjack, which is not how the personalities have been working up to this point. They've been like dormant personalities that have been like unconscious, usually is the way that they've been done, and they're basically like stuck in the moments before their death is usually how they've been framed. So this is a huge shift in the way they work now. But yeah, after the like melting and the gut full of shotgun shells and a couple of other cool fights, Blackjack kind of has a moment of clarity far too late again, where she's like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. This is a big fucking mistake. We need to leave. But like, it sticks this time, where they're basically like, Rampage is just like, all right, cool. I didn't want to be here either. I guess that's time up. All right, let's get our shit and go. And like,
sorry, I just want to interject. Like the like my fanon conception of Blackjack, like just went like dad mode. Okay, sweetie, do you need to tap out? Okay, we can tap out.
You like, want like, you want to get some orange slices?
Like, I am amused by the idea that like Blackjack is like just Hobbs the Tiger to Blackjack Calvin.
You've been saying Blackjack like, every time, like, by the way, just to let you know. I think you meant Rampage.
Oh, right. No, so Rampage is Hobbs the Tiger to Blackjack's Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
Is a fun dynamic to imagine, that like it really is just sort of just relentless patronizing, like that's part of why Rampage is here, is sort of patronizing and like kind of like faintly amused.
Yeah.
But
I don't want to play in the Hell Tower anymore. I want to go home.
That's okay, sweetie. We can you can tap out at any time.
You did your best. Back it up. We'll get him next time.
It's good to see you reach for the stars, but it's like it's also important you learn your limits.
But yeah, so this charming moment of self-clarity that was cut short when like Shears is like, no, wait, no, you can't do that. That wasn't part of the deal. This is what we agreed to. And she's like, no, I'm tapping out. Like, I'm done. We're gonna die if we keep doing this. And he's like, I don't think you understand. I wasn't, like, this wasn't an option. And then he, like, since he's a necromancer, that was a factoid we learned last week, he just, like, hurls some fucking necromantic black magic at her. And is basically, like, basically to the rest of the people, it's like, okay, so Blackjack's soul is currently unwinding out of her body. And you need to listen to me or she's dead. Like, and I like, and holding her hostage, which of course just like Blackjack just like tough guys out of like the pain of having her soul wrenched in her body, which we're told is painful in an extreme way. But because it's like, because it's a soul damage, we have no way of like graphing it onto our own perceptions. So it's impossible to really like empathize with the pain that she's going through, but she's like, eh, I've had worse. And it's like, okay, cool. But now we have a new timer that's been thrown onto the story, that if they don't get Mr. Shears what he wants in the tower, Blackjack just dies. Which, I mean, like, cool. Like, on the one hand, if she lives, we have to keep reading the story. But on the other hand, if she dies, we don't have to read it anymore. So I'm torn.
Yeah. Sure, you bet.
So I'm torn on my feelings on this development. But yeah, and also most of the other crew also just, like, has other reasons for why they're going in the tower and they want to stick it out. Okay. But yeah, my notes here just is just Blackjack is so tough and so strong.
I mean, I am kind of amused by, like, there is, there could be something to, like, oh, this is a real fun parlor trick. I'm sure somebody with limited life experiences would think that this was, like, a real agony of the spirit. Fortunately, you're dealing with somebody, like, whose inner essence is well and scarred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's also just something that, like, we can't as a audience really empathize, because, like, you can't feel a soul. So he's like, okay, your soul is hurting. What does that mean? Is that like heartburn? Like, is that like the equivalent of like gastrointestinal distress? Does it feel like she's on fire? Like, it's really hard to empathize with something that's like that sort of description.
If that's the sum of it, I'm having flashbacks to American Gods and Neil Gaiman explaining what it feels like to have your soul torn apart, and that's scary.
Yeah,
like having Anubis like eat you, and what that means is that he examines you, and you have to be made aware of everything he's looking at. Like, so it's a excruciating self-examination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded of the, like, that thing from Hitchhiker's Guide where it's like makes you aware of how infinitesimally small you are in the universe, and that just like kills you somehow. Like, it was never really clear on how that makes you dead, but like being that aware of how insignificant of you are kills you somehow.
Is so overawed, you spend the rest of your life in a coma.
just looked at my later notes.
Anyway, so yeah, all right. So we've now got a ticking clock.
Yeah, Blackjack's soul will unweave out of her body if this doesn't get fixed. But yeah, Rampage keeps sliding into her other headmates. They have a big old giant ghoul slobber knocker that is the dumbest thing. Like, I was just dying inside the entire time this was happening, because one of Rampage's like headmates, I don't know which one it is, I don't think it really goes in detail which one it is, starts like singing folk songs for some reason. Specifically, it's singing a bona fide version of 16 Tons, because which, I don't know, like, it's a song about coal, and coal's a big thing in FOE, so I guess it kind of makes sense, but, like...
Sure.
But, like, that's the most flimsy thing ever.
I'm so dead inside on, like, any of these shenanigans that are gonna happen with Rampage. Mainly because, like, I've long since stopped calling her horse pool, because, like, now she's mine. She's my...
She's your small horse daughter.
This is a very transitive character invented by some Nazi editor of Somber's, and then taken over by Somber, and now he's doing this. And, like, meanwhile, like, divorced from all this multiple personality horse shit, this, like, very bad conception of multiple personality horse shit, like... I'm very invested in my vision of the character, and so, like, I'm like tuned out and turned off at, like,
you're writing my baby
all
wrong.
These fucking shenanigans with, yeah,
yeah.
So, like, yeah, I'm just very detached from it.
There is,
and also, like,
yes,
I'm also just thinking about, like, interesting ways that Lacuna and Rampage, like, if Rampage weren't taken up with all of this horseshit.
Mm-hmm.
So to speak, like, could respond to, like, oh, you've done this thing to our fearless leader, huh? All right,
yeah.
And
we're gonna kill you slowly now, like, in ways you did not know were possible.
I mean, two responses I can think of is, like, my conception of Rampage would take it in stride and go, that's a thing you did. Well, yes, we certainly are in your mercy. Let's go ahead and finish out the building. I was curious as to what was the top anyway. And, like, have the unstated thing, like, that, like, just sort of a... There's another secret ticking clock, like a sort of a Hitchcockian, like, time bomb of, like, the second mission's over, like, well, that was a fun thing you did. Good job. Now it is time to pay the price. And Lacuna, like, based on what she is, like, I can't help but imagine, like, her putting an oversized goth princess hoof on Blackjack's, the top of Blackjack's head, and just extracting it.
Yeah.
And just like, oh, this soul pain, huh? Om nom nom.
So it's...
pretty neat gimmick you got there.
Yeah. It'd be a shame if you didn't have a giant receptacle of soul agony right next to you. Just gonna drag and drop into this horse.
You gonna play around with some black magic in the with horse Lucifer hanging around?
Yeah. There is a slight thing to mention, the fact that, like, a very specific hole in the goddess's magical repertoire is specifically necromancy, as it's like a very specifically hidden art that's from the original story, and I'm not going to get into it. It's very hard to explain, but it makes more sense than you'd immediately think. Like, why didn't she just, like, because it becomes the problem of, like, the goddess is the sum totality of thousands of unicorns and their magic. So how is it that they don't just solve every problem that ever comes across? And the answer is that, like, the magic that they need, they don't have, no one knows except for, like, a very small number of people, and none of those people are make up the, like, body of the goddess. So, whatever. But there's a weird bit of an aside after they sing 16 Tons where Rampage, like, like there's a great, like, moment of hilarity, actually, where, like, like, Rampage gives, like, Shears a look, and like, Blackjack goes, like, Rampage, and she's like, don't Rampage me. You know what I'm gonna do to him. You can't just let every single person live. Which feels way more self-aware than it should. it was really funny to me to just be like, it's like, no, I'm gonna kill him. You can't just keep letting people get away with things. And if I didn't know that Blackjack was a fucking, like, cop rapist, the sequence of Rampage's sort of coming to Jesus moment over the course of this chapter, because this is where it starts to really hammer home the idea that, like, Rampage is unsure of why she follows BJ outside of just, and she's just been passing off the concept of, like, that as just, oh, I'm bored. I'm a bored immortal and whatever. I just felt like hanging around with this nerd. But, like, starting to really come to terms with, like, but, like, what's special about Blackjack? And if I bought into BJ's hype, it would be that she's too good. Like, she's just a good person, and it's hard not to want to follow that. But knowing that, like, Blackjack is, like, a fucking disaster and also a rapist, like, kind of sullies that quite a bit. Like, if this was, like, Lil Pip or a bunch of other protagonists of better stories, I could definitely, like, I could totally see this making more sense to me. They're like, oh yeah, there's this raider is just kind of wandering around hanging out with this good aligned hero nerd, and, like, why is she doing that? And even she's not really sure of it, and it's, like, part of something of a redemption arc to realize that, like, she just enjoys being around this good person more than she enjoys being around, like, the violent murderers that she normally hangs out with. And, like, I don't know, I guess, whatever, fodder for a better story, in my opinion. Anyways, where are we on my notes? Oh, okay, so they get to one of the road, like, the road stops they wanted to get to over the course of this story, where the Nurse Graves wanted to check out the medical area because she wanted to see what happened to all of her, like, co-workers at the prison, because she got out before the bombs hit. And finds that most of them are dead, like, most of them are, like, dead, like, they didn't even ghoulify, they got, like, vaporized and or something. And if this was another case of, if this character was a character that was more in the story, I'd be way more invested in this plight, where she's, like, you know, the concept of a, like, 200-year-old zombie, like, tragically wandering around her old life and, like, you know, in a melancholic way, like, reminiscing about all these, like, goofy stories about all of her friends, and, like, the sort of background juxtaposition of, like, oh yeah, this is a story about cute, dumb horses having fun adventures, or like the original story was, and this like tragic juxtaposition of that past pre-war with this like tragic, horrible post-apocalyptic wasteland would be really effective if Nurse Graves was a character that was in the story more than just a weird tag-along for this particular arc. So I find I just don't care nearly as much as I would, but I can definitely see how this would have an effect on me if this character was a bigger... Like, whatever, like, the yeah. bones are there. It's just that, like, it's hard for me to care for a total stranger.
Yeah, it's a clever enough idea, but, yeah.
But yeah, this scene is cut short when one of the like guard like gets up and tries to attack her, and they like decapitate the like guard and realize that it's like one of the things this necromancy like this prison was testing was like taking souls and putting them into armor to try and make like soul armor that's indestructible, and the like sneaking suit is like the like success of the project, but there's a bunch of failures wandering around. It like catches fire, is to my understanding, like this. So this would be a really, if this thing had a voice and a name and a character behind it, this would be a really cool evocative concept where it's like, it's an undead soul-bound armor that is perpetually on fire, and it's like radioactive fire. So it's this really nonsense like green balefire is either green or blue, no one really knows. I'm just going to say maybe blue, whatever. So it's this crazy blue fire, like flaming, headless armor, which feels so much almost like a boss fight-like character, but it doesn't have a name or a personality of any kind outside of this narrative description. So, like, I'm just left wanting. Like, I'm just missing the Sanguine show with the Metal Gear bosses, I guess, again. Because this basically just is a high-level regular enemy as far as I'm concerned, and that's not really good to do in a story. But yeah, they have a couple of... They have a big old rumble with it, because they can't really kill it, because soul armor is effectively indestructible, and it'll keep just moving until they can stop it. Graves gets blasted and dies. Shears, in a moment of heroic sacrifice, like, pushes Silver Spoon out of the way so that she doesn't get clam baked, and like, you know, like I talked about before, but Shears is like a mummy. Like he's a ghoul, but he's covered head to toe in bandages for some mysterious reasons. And he gets like caught on fire, and all of his bandage burns up in this scene. And we'll get to that in a hot second. They end up beating this thing by like they're in the medical wing. They like throw the corpse out of a window, and there's a tense moment where he's trying to drag Blackjack off the side, and they kick him off, and he like falls down the entirety of the like the middle shaft of the prison, and kind of bouncing off a bunch of things, then crashing into the nuclear warhead in the middle, which kind of like shifts it a little, which is foreshadowing for something that happens later. So keep that in mind. Oh, man, Blackjack blacks out for a while, and we get a super long scene destroying. Cutscene moment where Blackjack is in the body of Psalm, and she's remembering the time when she enlisted, and it just so happens that when she enlisted was like all of the other people that would eventually become Macintosh Marauders were all there, and it's the like moment where they all met, and this is when they all decided to become like part of the same squad or whatever. And like, if I gave a shit about these characters, this would be kind of a contextually sad scene where we see like out of chronological order, this really sad, like this very cheery scene where we see like a bunch of friends all like joining up to do the war effort, and like the sort of tragic juxtaposition of knowing all of their lives were made absurdly worse and awful for various different reasons. Like Psalm became an assassin, Twist died violently, Echo is just gone, Stonewing got turned into a horrible monster, Deus became a terrifying pain robot. Like if any of these characters didn't suck, the effect of basically getting the like postcard that shows all the happy faces of all the like heroes of the way of like of the heroes of the past, and then like counterpointing that with like the tragic ends all of them met in the wastes, where they all die terrible, horrible, painful, like, ends in various ways. But I just don't like the Marauders, so, like, this just has no effect on me.
Meanwhile, I'm sort of lamenting that we no longer have to... We no longer have, like, increasingly hilarious, like, orb-saturated wastelands, like, where they're, like, falling out of the ceiling tiles. Or,
and
like,
donking her in the head.
Because Blackjack has, after her near-death experience, connected to the orb force.
The orb force.
And so any sufficient, like, trauma will resync her with the orb force.
Oh, man.
So they're now ethereal orbs that are just sort of bouncing invisibly around.
So
until Blackjack is sufficiently traumatized.
This is going to be a long episode because we have one last scene, but this scene is dense with shit.
Okay.
So strap in, folks. First of all, Blackjack wakes up to the sound of, like, Rampage, like, fiddling with some chemicals. And when she, like, starts talking to her, it becomes really painfully obvious that it's not, like, the default Rampage that we're used to, and it's one of her headmates, Dr. Octopus, and he's like starts talking about her and starts ruminating about like how the like presence of Hightower for whatever reason is making her, like, Rampage's headmates more aware and more cognizant and like more capable of being able to like do whatever, and it's revealed that like they've sort of come to a consensus in Rampage's head about how to like operate, and they're all sort of like less taking like control independently. They're now sort of like operating by consensus on how they work, and that like, and it seems the going theory from Octopus seems to be that like there's a default Rampage that is kind of like a weird mush of all of the other headmates, but then they all also have like their own and like personalities that can kind of like weigh in on different things, and luckily enough of them vote to help Rampage to help Blackjack over the ones that don't want to help her, that Rampage can continue to do what she's doing, but she's kind of like evolved into a completely different character at this point. And this is the character I remember the most. Like,
she has become a Disco Elysium.
I don't get that reference yet because I haven't played it.
Okay, I've heard a bunch of reviews and spoilers. Actually, it's not that much of a spoiler. It's the core premise of the game. Your stats have personalities, yeah, and they weigh in on the situation.
Yeah, so she's become the thing I think is super cool, which is a gestalt entity that's like kind of a weird mush between a central identity that's kind of a combination of all six of them, and all of them like weighing in their own governing experiences, which again would be super cool if Rampage was the protagonist and not a weird side character. Like, if this was her actual arc of like learning to come to terms with her broken brainness and like becoming a superior being, like becoming a better, more well-balanced person by like coming to an agreement with her own headmates, would be super cool. But because of the way this is done, it's kind of done like absently in the middle of Blackjack's memory orb pass out.
This validates my earlier half joke that like this is Sombra putting his stank on somebody else's OC. Like, okay, this is now my character. Like, as long as I now have this fucker in my story. And I don't have that you know other dip to like complain when I do things that he doesn't like with it. Like, it's now my character. I'm gonna gonna do what I want with it. And so, like, I guess congrats to Sombra for me like now praising him, because he's like the thing he's decided to do is like precisely what I said like a million years ago,
yeah,
on the pod, like dozens of episodes ago. No, it should be a fluid gestalt. Especially by now. So like, I guess aces to hit, like, you know, good job, Somber. And I can also, I also feel pretty confident that if it were way fewer, if it were way less of a clown car of different competing ideas, and we're like only like three personalities, like this would be perfectly valid. Like, I could see like, a like Mass Effect 2 like style and quality of game having this as a companion character.
Mm-hmm.
And their arc through the story, like every time we check back in on them, they're like wrestling with like their own nature and like mm-hmm. the current state of the consensus of their competing internal interests.
Well, the big shame about Rampage's headmates is that like there's like six of them, but like we only ever really see like three most of the time. It's Doc Ock, the Baby Killer, and Shuja. And kind of Twist, but very rarely. But this concept, I think, is really cool. And like narratively, it's kind of fun to now have like so as shit as the road has been to it, the concept of having like okay, all of them have distinct voices that we now recognize because of the weird like memories that they like the trapped memory versions we've had of them, but that they're now lucid and aware of the circumstances that they're going through. So and they have the two centuries of Rampage file data to work through, including all of the memories of Blackjack, and they're like, and so there's like duality of they can like add their own take and experiences and personality on top of the pre-existing knowledge that they have of their relationship with Blackjack. So we get like a lot of really cool like there's a lot of really cool like Doc Ock and Twist and Shuja like weighing in their own respective unique ways on things that have happened between them and Blackjack and their own responses to Blackjack. It's kind of a weird circumstance where now to them, Blackjack has suddenly became like an old friend to them that they never knew about. Like it's suddenly just been like added to their like added to their list of memories is their memories of a different person that is also them, paradoxically. I don't know, this is the thing I really like. Like, I really like gestalt entities, and I'm a big sucker for them. I'm a big sucker for hive minds. So this is the kind of thing I'm really, like, flappy hand excited about to talk about.
Fusion is a cheap tactic to make weak horses stronger.
Exactly. This is... Okay. So we've had all that goodwill, all that cool stuff about gestalt entities. All right, we got it.
Yeah.
Wanna like roll that up into a big ball in a picnic basket and throw it into the garbage. So that's all good, but we now need to deal with a much worse version of the exact same thing happening. So they're also like Lacuna is like, okay, BJ, I need to talk to you, and BJ's like, okay, what's going on?
I began this episode joking about, okay, well, thank God this will be like a chapter where shit happens. It's not like they're gonna lock themselves in a broom closet and whoops.
That's literally what happens. So Lacuna's like, okay, we need to talk. So remember how your brain's full of tumors, specifically taint-based tumors? So that's kind of how like the goddess works, like how the goddess makes alicorns. So you have a bunch of alicorn tumors in your brain, which normally wouldn't mean anything, but since we just exposed you to a fuck ton of radiation and your genes are kind of loopy, you are now sufficiently mutated enough to be considered part of, like, to be connected to the goddess unity network. So Blackjack bafflingly now has a direct mind link to the goddess like the rest of the alicorns do, but she's not under control like she can't, like they can't assume direct control like they can with Lacuna. She just has the goddess in her brain. Keep in mind, the goddess is not a character from this story. This is from the original thing. This is literally a plot tumor, because the next book coming up is going to deal so much with this shit. The story stops deader than it ever has to go and deal with this whole BJ is now connected to the goddess now thing. And it's like one of the most trite cliches of this particular genre, this particular side story like medium, of connecting stuff back to the goddess because she's a psychic character. It's easy to do. But it's just so cheesy. It's such a like unnecessary way to interact with the main story. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I don't. You have enough brain tumors that you can connect to the Wi-Fi.
Yes. You are now a Wi-Fi hotspot. Oh shit, that actually happens, doesn't it? Don't worry about it. Pay no attention to that. We got more. We got more. leave it for next for the book wrap up. We also learn that like Lacuna has some mysterious secrets that she doesn't want Blackjack to know about, because Blackjack can now, because Lacuna has always been able to probe into people's minds, Blackjack can now do it back to her in a kind of way, in terms of being connected to this. But Lacuna is like hiding her memories from BJ.
I hate this. I hate it.
It don't stop coming. But we also learn a whole bunch of backstories and shit.
Of course we do.
Because Xanthe is working on one of Blackjack's legs that have been busted up. And there's kind of a running gag about Blackjack missing one of her legs and kind of hobbling around because of it. We learn Xanthe's pointless fucking backstory that has nothing to do with this fucking setting. Where she's like a zebra on the eastern coast and all this shit about how her like tribe lived in a bunker and how like the zebra remnant showed up and basically demanded tithe of her people, and she was press-ganged into the remnant as a small child. And that the remnant is all about the fact that they want to destroy Equestria because they believe that like the war never ended, because the last Caesar, the last Kaiser never like died without ever giving him like a cease and desist on the war thing, so they believe that they're carrying on the tradition and will of that by trying to destroy Equestria. We learn more about Rome, which is the capital in some that follow Equestria, where they built up their whole civilization and it was destroyed when they called down a star, which stars are like eldritch beings in this setting that blew up the city by the star Catarai, which means there's a specific ethnic minority within the zebras that did this. And they're hated for it. They're considered cursed. They're essentially like Roma within the zebra, because we always need a Roma equivalent in everything. It's just in every fantasy setting we need one, and they all have to be shifty. It's just law.
Actually, yeah, no, that reminds me. Like, that's sort of a weird running joke in the System Mastery podcast. Like, oh, we're doing a fantasy setting. And gypsies, there they are.
they're always there. But yeah, and we learned that like they managed to call down the star, but they couldn't harness its power, so it's just kind of sitting there somewhere. We learned that Shears' name is actually Snips, because he's a character from the original story, and this is a reveal that would not matter to most people. But Silver Spoon recognizes him because they were vaguely like they were part of the same age group in the story. But he basically reveals that like because he like. He doesn't look like a ghoul. He just looks like a regular horse, but he's just, like, old. He's just ageless. And I think his eyes are milky. I think that's the only difference. But he basically explains he's essentially like a lich. Like, he can't die because his, like... because of all this necromancy stuff, at one point, apparently they removed their own souls and put them back on their body, which, like, applied the soul jar of indestructibility effect to their own corpses. I guess. So he's essentially a body, he's a soul possessing his own body, which, I mean, how that's different from regular being alive, I don't know.
Or just regular being a zombie? Like, that just sounds like a regular zombie.
He's a super...
That's just how zombies work, isn't it? Like, that's...
Yeah, but he's basically a lich that's his phylactery is his own body.
I mean, that just sounds like a... Usually, like, that there's a reason Koshe the Deathless stores his soul in a needle, inside of an egg, inside of a duck, inside of a rabbit, inside of a tree. Like, you put that shit elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Or you've made your immortality redundant.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and his whole reason why he's here is because his best friend, Snails, is here. And he's also probably has the same affliction. So he's probably still alive. And they used to work for Rarity as necromancers, and they created a project called the Phoenix Talisman, which was some sort of immortality device that couldn't work, and they couldn't get it working, and most of their projects failed, and basically the entirety of the necromancy stuff that Rarity did utterly failed, except for the miniatures, which doesn't really matter to anybody. It's important to remember that the Phoenix Talisman is the thing that is keeping Rampage alive. And the explanation behind that of why it didn't work is that it does work. It just needs an absurd amount of souls to like work as a battery to run it. So the reason why Rampage has these like eclectic gang of weirdos in her body is because it has been traded hands for like 10 years between multiple people that would die. With it in their possession, their soul would jump into the soul jar. It would then go on to the next person and jump in their body. And it took like 7 people before it finally had enough soul juice for the battery to work. So Rampage is basically a giant soul battery. There is an implication by Xanthe that Rampage also has been accidentally stealing souls. I don't think that's actually the case, but like. There's an implication that everyone she's ever killed has had their soul stolen by the Phoenix Talisman. But that idea, I think, gets dropped literally a chapter later, so whatever. So we're almost done. The one last ratchet of tension is that they're running out of Rataway, which is the stuff they've been using to cure their radiation sicknesses. So they've been like recycling them using drugs at best they can, which... The final ratchet of tension is the whole like warhead that got dislodged by them like kicking it, basically like throwing a corpse at it, like dislodges so that it falls deeper into the system, which isn't enough to proc the warhead going off. But the fire that it's now on, is going to eventually cause the warhead to blow up. So now we have 2 different timers on. The warhead will eventually detonate, blowing up the building. And on top of that, BJ's soul is about to escape her body. And that's the end of our chapter.
Cool.
Any thoughts that wouldn't take too long to throw into a secondary episode that's a recap that you can think of at the top of your brain?
Action scenes or musical numbers?
I that sounds crazy to say aloud, but like that's totally right. I just never thought about it like that.
it's actually a fairly cold take. Like you can find it just about anywhere. But basically, like if the difference, like it, I think musicals are a really good teaching tool for like how to write an action scene, because like you can, it's much more transparent in a musical when a musical number is like there for its own sake. Like we have this jazzy number in mind. And director, you're gonna put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. there's like different schools of musical, and that I can't remember the like there's a history of like their popularity and the development of the styles and priorities, but most of the best musicals with. No, Blues Brothers isn't even an exception. The worst parts of the Blues Brothers is when the plot stops dead to do a musical number. And, like, there's only a couple musical numbers that really tie into, like, the action and the story of the plot. And that being Aretha Franklin's number, Respect, I think. And Bob's Country Bunker. Wherein, like, the musical number for that one was directly tied into, like, the action of the scene and the development of the plot in the moment. But, I think one of my favorite movie musicals of all time is The Nightmare Before Christmas, because every musical number has a purpose. Like, every musical number in that movie has a function. It's not perfect. There are some wherein, like, major plot events happen over the course of the number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could get a lot into musical theory. Well, the thing I was just going to say before you go is just it's the, I think the thing that is relevant is how its musical numbers are in a liminal space that are separated from the rest of the story, is I think what you're trying to get at.
Yeah. Basically, I think I feel like you're wasting my time if, like, the action scene does not in and of itself further the plot.
Yeah.
If the action scene isn't like a micro narrative that in some way pushes the motion of the story forward. And in this episode, we had a lot of like Fred Astaire numbers. Like, we had a lot of like, did somebody say haircuts? Haircuts. Wherein you could cut the whole number from the production and nothing would be substantially like changed. The story would still flow exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically all I had to I think action scenes should do a thing.
Yeah, they should move the
should
story
have
forwards.
Some.
Which I don't think is too extreme of a claim to make. But otherwise that's our chapter. Weird. Is there anything better we could in fact be consuming right now instead of this?
Well, Disco Elysium. If you wanna play Rampage as a balding, bearded, middle-aged man who discovers that he's a cop is in the middle of a murder investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Disco Elysium. Before the podcast began, the politics infuriate me, but I'm still playing it, which is a rare thing for me. Like, usually, bad politics. Politics bad, go away. I'll throw a thing out if I think it proposes a worldview I don't like. But Frostpunk, in spite of having no punk, a lot of frost but no fucking punk,
mm-hmm.
is a pretty entertaining city management sort of game. It's an interesting and challenging puzzle. And I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but conservatives tell on themselves a lot, and due to the sort of nature of these micromanagement city building simulator things, you are a totalitarian leader of this group of desperate refugees clinging to life and safety and health, and as a result, things can only get worse for you because all of your solutions to the failing hope of the populace mostly involve protecting your position of power.
Yeah.
And as such, all of the solutions the game presents to you are brutally authoritarian. I could do a whole fucking essay on if you could play this game from an anarchist perspective. I wish I had anarchist auctions, and I think the main thing keeping me playing the game is my stubbornness and let's see how successful I can be. Let's see how hard I can rock this game by picking the most benevolent options available and see how minimally I can draw from the pool of the fascist toolbox the game presents you as the morale maintaining options. So I'm playing the game to spite it.
You carry on.
Yeah.
Sadly, I have nothing to recommend. I've been dealing with dentists and picking up commissions so that I can fucking live and pay off my dentist bills for the last couple of days. So I've just had nothing to really consume. I picked up a video game called It's Winter that I think is a interesting video game, but it suffers from mechanical problems. Its sensitivity is impossible to tweak down, and it's very, very high, and it makes the game very nauseating to play. But it's interesting. It sells itself as a sandbox walking simulator, which I'm pretentious enough to like walking simulators. So that sounds like a look.
Oh man, yeah, no, well, yeah, depending on the walking simulator, I love the.
I have yet to find a walking simulator that I found particularly bad, except for maybe. I think maybe They've All Gone to the Rapture is kind of bad, but it's just because like, it's a very like, it's a built on a twist that isn't interesting in my opinion. So whatever, but that's a different podcast. That's our walking simulator podcast.
Tune in. Okay, so
time for the plug.
Fi has an extremely not safe for work,
and it's only getting more not Twitter. Safe for work by the day, as it turns out.
Fi is committing some pretty grotesque horse crimes. So like, I guess what's the word I'm looking for? Caveat. Heads up. At least one of us is a horse pervert as well. So I don't know. Takes one to know one.
Yeah. But I also do talk about politics and lots of leftivism stuff. I usually yell about artists and their role in society.
I only talk about politics and occasionally, I think ideally more and more frequently, like just gibber creative ideas rather than just gibbering about like the hottest political takes I can make, like almost. Yeah, so that's Thou Art Fi for Not Safe for Work. At Weirdington E for safe to work and currently not updating nearly often enough. You can email me directly with your thoughts for the podcast. Our podcast's effective official email is at Weirdington Esquire. That's at Weirdington ESQ at gmail.com. Please remember to like us. Click every thumbs up and heart you can find that's associated with our podcast on whatever is your service you're listening to it. Please feed the algorithm gods with comments.
Reviews will also be really, really valuable. You can also donate directly to Weird's Ko-Fi page, which will be a LinkedIn thing. We will definitely, December is, even though I said November is going to be the first one, December is going to be the start of our Patreon with... But we're gonna do a Patreon. It'll be like a one to $2 buy-in, which will I think something that we're gonna be trying to add is I'm gonna start trying to do transcripts of episodes for people who like can't really grok audio listening situations, which just in case you want to palate to your friends and think we make some good takes and like, but they can't handle listening to podcasts. But otherwise, we're also going to be doing bonus episodes. The first bonus episode will be a review of the, like, Fall Equestria, one of the Fall Equestria pen and paper is one of the more well-known ones. It's extremely bad, and we both know our tabletops pretty well, so it should be a fun ride. We will likely look into doing some other smaller reviews of some other, like, properties within the sci-fic universe, the ficiverse. Maybe we'll talk about the video games that exist, just sort of, like, detritus that exists in this community that people may not be aware of, and outsiders can have a fun laugh at like how crazy and weird and dense this community was at one point and how it's kind of dropped off in the more recent years.
Sounds like some exciting stuff.
Yeah, it'll be some fun episodes.
Thank you for listening, you poor damned fools. Don't you realize this has all been a terrible mistake?